You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. We're on Twitter, as always, at KUOW. And we're about to talk about sexual abuse. And I really hope you're not reaching for your radio dial right now, because that's part of the problem. Seattle's mayor has quit because of allegations that he sexually abused teenage boys decades ago. Murray denies those allegations. This is beyond this one case. This is a crisis that maybe you'd rather not face. Couldn't you be listening to Warm 106.9 or something right now? Well, think about it. What happens when you close your ears and you close your eyes to sexual abuse? In the studio with me now is Janice Palm, who works with survivors of sexual abuse at Shepherd's Counseling Service. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you.
Come close to that microphone, will you? And Dan Knopfler, who works with sex offenders. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Janice, what happens when we change the radio station and continue to avoid this topic?
Boy, that is a very easy answer. It continues. Sexual abuse continues because there's silence around it.
Dan, you work with offenders. What does our silence mean to this problem?
It splits apart families in the long run.
Yeah.
It's very hard on everyone.
Let's get into this and what we could possibly do better. First of all, do we change the station because sexual abuse seems both awful and private and unsolvable, Janice?
I think so. You know, I say this not infrequently. If you say the words, "I work with adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse," those words together in a sentence bring up a picture nobody wants to look at. There isn't a part of that that we want to see. I think we have a visceral reaction to the whole topic, to thinking that it happens. It is just uncomfortable to think about.
Could it be better if we, what could we do instead of being uncomfortable? Because it just seems intractable.
I think acknowledging, you know, that it happens. The statistics tell us that. For people who are adults now, we know the averages are 1 in 6 boys, 1 in 4 girls have had some experience of sexual abuse before they're 18. That generalizes, that averages to 1 in 5.
That's 1 in 6 boys, 1 in 4 girls.
Right.
Dan, why would somebody sexually abuse someone else, especially a young person?
Well, it crosses a continuum. The kids I work with tend to be curious kids. They don't tend to be sort of the deviant, predatory person that you would expect that does this kind of thing. As adults, there's a lot of people who are dissatisfied in their lives and use sex as a way to cope and distract themselves from their life that they really don't like. And it's a really destructive way to cope. But most people, there's an element of that as part of their acting out.
Yeah. Cope and distract. That's a little more complicated than how it's framed usually.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Before we leave the topic of silence, since we're not being silent now, Janice, this idea, this unwillingness to open our eyes to talk about 1 in 5 young people being a victim of sexual abuse, will you give me an example of how does that affect your clients? Tell me a story.
Being sexually abused in childhood is really, honestly, a very devastating thing to happen. Children are confused. They don't understand what's happening to them. They're not at a level of sexual development where this fits for them or makes sense for them. You know, there can be an element of fear involved. Often there is, certainly confusion. So, you know, and we also know that kids don't tell. Kids generally don't speak up and say what happened to them because they're afraid and because they're traumatized. When people are traumatized, it's really hard to have words, put the story together, say what happens, and children may simply not have the words to talk about what happened to them because they don't understand it. So it's a secret. And what happens is that the trauma goes inside and people become far less trusting. If I thought I could trust the world, if I thought I was safe, and I find out that I'm not safe anymore, well then, who can I trust? It's better not to get close to people. We see a lot of symptoms that are just flat out PTSD. People often wait decades to talk about this, and I think that bears out in the stories we've heard in the Murray situation. These men waited decades to speak up. That's not unusual. And it's usually when life gets too hard, too complicated, can't put relationships together, can't get close to people, or simply, you know, honestly, flashbacks are disturbing my sleep so much I can't hold a job, for instance, then people will reach out and get help. But it causes enormous ripples throughout a person's life.
Janice, you just brought up the case of Seattle's mayor, former mayor now, who denies these allegations, which is part of what we're talking about. Are you comfortable using, as you just did, the name of one person who denies the charges when we're talking about sexual abuse? That he says never happened.
It's so characteristic, I have to say. You know, I don't know. We probably will never know the resolution of this. We may never say, okay, conclusively he did or didn't. Likely we won't. But I have to say that the denial, I didn't do it, flat out, I didn't do it, the discrediting of the victims, saying, look at their lives, they're not credible, this is very, very, very characteristic of abusers. They're trying to distance themselves from what happened too. They want it not to come out. And so they deny it. And it's very damaging. It's very wounding to people who've been hurt deeply and sexually abused.
Dan, what helpful could come out of the case of Seattle's now ex-mayor?
Well, so my experience starting in the 80s doing this work is that it wasn't unusual that offenders had multiple victims. But we've really come a long way in 30 years. Like, a person with 5, 10, 20 victims is an outlier these days. And so talking about sexual abuse, talking about kids having the right to say, I'm not comfortable with that kind of touching of my body, and really empowering people to take charge of their lives has really changed things. And so the talking helps. The other thing is, and you know, the research regarding people who've been abused is, the more they could talk about what they've had happen to them, the more they're believed, the more they're supported, the better the outcome. So by having this cloud of silence over sexual assault, we're actually making people who've been sexually abused worse. We are exacerbating symptoms that don't have to be exacerbated. We are making their lives much more miserable and difficult. So if we can talk about it, we believe them, we trust that their memories are accurate, we don't discredit them, they have a lot to gain. And they aren't coming in for services 20 years later and have all these destructive and negative things going on in their life.
How do we balance believing accusers with the rights of the accused?
Well, so I think families, you know, can believe a person. That doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a conviction coming down the road. You need children, unless there are really clear ulterior motives, don't lie about these things. They really do not. Like, if there's, you know, the times when there are sometimes false allegations or during really heated custody disputes and things along those lines. But in general, by and large, kids in particular, there's so many negative pressures for saying that this happened, that what was said before is, the reality is most don't tell rather than overreport. Like, those statistics probably grossly underestimate how many people are actually being sexually assaulted. And the reality beyond that is, if it's dad, grandpa, uncle, your favorite neighbor, right, there isn't just, there are so many other consequences, because if dad goes to prison, mom may end up living in the homeless shelter with the kids because he's the primary source of income. And so there's a lot, or grandpa and grandma will never talk to us again, or Uncle Joe is going to have to leave the state or whatever it may be. So the reality that kids falsely report is is really not an accurate thing for the most part.
We're talking with Dan Knopfler, who's a certified sex offender treatment provider in South King County, and Janice Palm, who works with survivors of sexual abuse. Dan, on the offender side, what's one thing we could do to prevent sexual abuse from ever happening? What's something a listener right now, who you've made us care, we're still listening to KUOW right now, what can I do?
So draconian laws may feel good in the short term when it comes to people who've committed sexual assault, but the reality is the person least likely to reoffend is a person who has a stable life and a reason to care and a reason not to get back into trouble. So there has to be punishment, but it needs to be balanced with a sense of, like, they need to have a chance to have a life. So they need to have a place to live. They need to have a job. They need to have, again, a reason to live. And if you can just take a tiny step back and not say, you know what, they deserve to be, you know, tossed in the gutter forever, it will help. And the reality is there'll be less sexual assault that occurs because these guys aren't going to go out and hurt someone if they have a life that's worth living.
Okay, two questions on that then. Is there anything we lose by somehow easing up on the hostility, the condemnation that we share of sexual abusers? And number two, is that even realistic? You know, is it realistic for us to not think of sexual abusers as vile? It almost seems hardwired. So there's two questions in there, right? We sometimes societal condemnation serves a purpose. You know what I'm talking about. What
Absolutely.
Do we do about that?
Well, there's a difference between making it clear that something is wrong and there's a consequence for your actions and making them pariahs. Like, there's a huge difference. And I'm not saying they shouldn't have legal consequences, that some should go to prison. All those things are true. But when, you know, our country has a belief about, like, you do your time and then you get a chance to rehabilitate yourself. And so I'm just saying that once people have taking care of that consequence, give them a chance to rehabilitate themselves. And that includes housing, that includes working, that includes having some semblance of an okay life. I mean, I don't think that's an outrageous, you know, request from my standpoint.
Do you have friends who are former sexual abusers? Can you have love for former sexual abusers? I'm just wondering how you process this in your work.
So what people, I think, forget is many times the person who abused someone is very close and dear to them. And many times it's ironic. The person who's been abused may actually be the most forgiving of the offender of anyone, because especially children, they have this remarkable ability to see people as multifaceted, multidimensional people. Mm. You know, Uncle Joe may have been the guy who actually cared the most about this kid and cross that boundary, but at the same time may have spent the most time, listened the most closely to this person. And so like sometimes a person who's been abused may be the most forgiving, and actually their anger may be directed more at peripheral adults in the system who didn't believe them and failed to protect them. Like there's sort of a strange irony sometimes about that.
Yeah. But boy, the person who cared the most crossed the boundary. I mean, so Janice, you work with survivors. Do you disagree with anything that Dan just said, honestly?
I don't. I mean, honestly, this is a very, very, very complex topic. And it's hard to nail it down. You know, we've got humans on both sides of this. We've got humans who are the perpetrators. We've got humans who are the abused. So there's a lot of complexity. And it's true. I think one of the things, and this is goes toward prevention, is understanding that 90% of abusers are known to the child. I think when we think about child sexual abuse, we think about, you know, the guy in the park in the raincoat. And there are some guys in the park in the raincoats, for sure, who are looking to molest children. That's the statistics tell us these are people in a child's life who have made friends with them, have maybe honestly been a good friend to them, taught them how to play basketball, taught them things that they wouldn't have known, cared about them, given them things that they wouldn't otherwise have. We can call this grooming. Yes, it's grooming. But for a child, that really complicates the situation. So these are situations where, you know, in those situations, a child doesn't know. They don't understand, you know, is this person hurting me? Are they helping me? What's going on here? It can take decades to figure that out. So there's a lot of complexity to this.
Janice, do you fault our system, our society, when sometimes you tell somebody and they don't help you? Reporters don't always publish. Prosecutors don't always charge. Caseworkers don't always get involved. You know, does it have to be that way? You could almost call it a conspiracy of silence. No one's guilty, right? But there's the system.
Yeah, we're all guilty of it. It's hard. And to be honest, if you know, for parents, I do a little bit of prevention work, and I tell young parents, you know, it's if your child comes to you and says, you know, Uncle so-and-so touched me, there's going to be a lot going on if you're the parent, because outing this, talking about this is a hard thing to do. It's going to create chasms. It's going to create a lot of trouble in your family. It would be easier to say, oh, he really didn't mean it. And so I do think we need to acknowledge this happens. This causes enormous harm. We need to be talking about it. We need to understand it happens. But we also need probably more compassionate ways of dealing with it when it happens, so that it doesn't need to be such high stakes, such a black and white issue. Abusers need help, definitely. And children need to be safe. There's no question about that.
I think you're telling us listeners right now, be courageous. This hurts. This is scary. You know, you be courageous.
Yeah.
Step up. There's help. There's people who like you who know a lot, right? That, you know, you can learn about this. You can learn how to talk to people. We've got other topics for today, and there's so much here, but Janice, how do you have hope? I can't imagine the stories you hear, the things, the images in your mind. Help us have some hope, if there is.
There is hope, and it is. I mean, it sounds strange, but I feel like I'm sort of on the lucky end of this equation, because by the time people go through what they need to go through in themselves to reach out and ask for help, they know what that means. They know that they're going to be talking about the hardest parts of their life, the most painful things for them. They've already made that decision with themselves, and they ask for help. So I'm on the receiving end of that. And yeah, it is about holding human suffering. And it's very hard sometimes to consider what human beings are capable of doing to other human beings. That's difficult. But I also have this amazingly lucky job of getting to see how when people reach out for help, they get it. They can learn to heal. Their lives get better than they ever thought they could have been before. And all the effort that's gone into coping and keeping this pushed aside now can go into living your life, having vitality, having spontaneity, having creativity, growing relationships that are truly healthy and good. That is absolutely the hopeful part.
Dan, same question to you then as we wrap it up. What gives you hope?
Well, so there's a lot of meaning in what I do, because it's meaningful to feel like I'm part of preventing sexual assault from continuing to occur. And again, similar to people who've been victimized, getting this wound exposed and cleaned and letting it heal, right, is a very gratifying job to be a part of. And sitting with people in their unhappiness and their misery is a difficult job. But, you know, when I go home at the end of the night, I feel good about what I've done. And people do get better. And some of the early statistics in the 80s and 90s about, like, there was, you know, to this day, we're still battling an issue where 80% of these men reoffend. And that's just bogus science. There's actually a lot of really good science that's occurred in the last, and research that's occurred in the last 30 years, that interventions help. And the recidivism rates aren't nearly as horrible and scary as people once thought. So intervention works on both sides of this issue. There's only 100 of me in the state of Washington. There's only 100 of us who do this. And so,
wow.
So I, part of my hope is that I want more people to do the job I do, because the more we have people like me who are willing to work with these men who've made probably the most serious mistake in their life, the less will need me down the road. So,
Dan Knopfler, certified sex offender treatment provider in South King County. Janice Palm, therapist and director of Shepherd's Counseling Services. She works with survivors of sexual abuse. I want to thank both of you for coming in, talking about the news that we're all thinking about and the bigger crisis that lays beyond that, whether we want to think about it all the time or not. Thank you for doing it.
Thank you so much for doing this program.
Thank you very much.
KUOW's The Record continues in a moment.